in Cambridge and so well dressed is that we were there to collect this very nice Gruber Prize. And this is sort of, this gives you a sense of how many people were there. There were actually 52 people that signed those two papers by the Supernova Cosmology Project, led by Saul Perlmutter and IC team, led by Ryan Schmidt, and here represented also by Bruno. It's funny, I got this picture this morning, and I started to look at, who's the guy who actually signed on top of Ryan Schmidt's name? It's Adam Rees. I said, this is something interesting. Anyway, some psychology here. Anyway, so all right. So why did we get this prize? Of course, is because the supernova measurement started a great deal of excitement when we found that the at any given redshift, the supernovae seemed to be much fainter than they would have been otherwise, according to the paradigm at the time, namely that the universe was all made of regular matter, dark or invisible, but definitely not vacuum energy. So. By now, of course, I guess all of us had a little, hard time to even ourselves try understanding that, what we found being so revolutionary was really to be trusted. But I think by now there is so much supporting evidence from a lot of other completely independent techniques. So I think this result really stands out as being very, very credible. And of course, the good news is as we try to understand what the nature of dark energy is, it's really great to have all of these techniques available because, we'll need them all, or a good fraction of them, let's say, in order to be completely sure that what we're seeing. And maybe what I will also want to add about this is that in order to combine these measurements, of course, you need to understand very, very well the systematic uncertainties associated with each one of them. So I'll focus actually quite a bit on what are the systematic uncertainties we deal with in the type of research I do. And I think Bruno will do similar, but we'll try not to overlap too much. But as you see, it's a very impressive list of techniques which are either operating at the time or where there's good hope to have an interesting signal. I wasn't sure if there would be any people who haven't seen before. Anyway, just a brief review, how do we measure cosmological parameters from type 1a supernovae? The method itself is dog simple. You just essentially measure the ratio of brightnesses to supernovae at different redshifts. And that, of course, relates to the luminosity distance, which in turn relates to the integral over the inverse of the Hubble parameter. Which again includes all these different terms with all the fluids which we believe are in the universe and curvature. Say it again.
You deliberately make one of the two light bulbs bigger than the other.
This thing was bigger in my grasp sooner than I know. It was too late. But now, maybe there's something to be said about it. Anyway, just to show you how these bulbs look the kind of things we try to observe at the telescope, this is a combination of real data, and what we see now, of course, is a cartoon. So these type 1a supernovae, which we use, are very, very, very useful standard or standardized candles, and the reason we believe they are so homogeneous is that they actually arise from the combination. You have a binary system where a white dwarf accretes matter from the neighbor until it reaches the Chandrasekhar mass limit, at which point it explodes, and therefore you have a sort of an explosion with a very, with a threshold effect, the 1.4 solar masses, and that's why it would explain the standard candle nature of this thing. Now, what you see here is the time evolution of a supernova. This is actually almost real. It's a real data interpolated. And you see here that the time scale here is, you have about 3 weeks from the explosion to the top. And what I want to get at here is that we really need to measure that peak luminosity here in order to make an accurate distance estimate. As I will be telling you in a while, you also need to measure the width of this light curve because that turns out to correlate with the brightness. So the better you measure the peak and the width, the sharper your cosmology estimate will be. All right. So how sharp? Well, as I said, we start with something which has about a 40% scatter or so in brightness. Of course, it's more in extremes. But after you calibrate for this width, you're down to something like 7% estimate in distance. So that's the best we can do today. And of course, as we'll be coming back to, there is a little bit of hope that we can do a little better than this, and I'll explain that. All right. How does it work, the whole thing, in case you haven't seen it before? So, of course, we use optical CCD images, and we look at the, in a given patch of the sky with a time scale, which is, of course, comparable to the light curve time scale I was showing you. So, typically, 3 or so weeks times the 1 plus the redshift we're targeting. And the idea being that when you look at a new image and you subtract it, you subtract reference from the new image, on occasions you would see at some spots that there isn't some extra light. And if you are lucky, that turns out to be a supernova, which you then march on and build a light curve. Of course, after you got a spectrum, this one piece I'm skipping here, that you need, of course, to get a spectrum to identify that this supernova is indeed a type 1A. And once you collect a number of those, you put them in a Hubble diagram, and out of those, of course, you start comparing with models, and that's how you get your confidence levels. So that's sort of the quick rundown of how things work. And now, you might wonder why we get these banana shapes here. And let me just go through that very, very quickly. So what happens is that what I'm showing you here is a bunch of panels. Each panel corresponds to one given redshift. Now, just for, you know, to make it more clear, I just took integer steps of 0.2 here in redshift. And what you see is on the x-axis, the omega matter parameter versus the omega lambda. And of course, it's a full degeneracy between these two parameters at any given redshift. And this is very intuitive, right? If you think about in terms of, you know, mass density being like a brake and the omega lambda being the accelerator, for any given redshift, you can get the same distance if you press accordingly, and if you just tune your brake and you accelerate the accelerator. Now, however, that, of course, will change as a function of redshift because there are different powers of 1 plus z in front of these two terms in the Friedman equation. And therefore, as you march on to different redshifts, the degeneracy, of course, persists, but the angle changes, and even the width, and also the width. So the name of the game is to try to cover as wide a redshift as possible, and then you can just superimpose these things and hopefully get an overlap as possible. And in fact, we have bananas today in our these kind of graphs is because we don't have that many of the high redshift end. That's why it turns to sort of follow more of the black thing. So that's, you can do exactly the same argument, follow the same reasoning with the equation of state parameter, and the argument is the same there, that it's really important to have the wide redshift range to constrain several parameters at the same time. Now, so what is the status of this project? You know, I showed you the Hubble diagram as it looked almost 10 years ago. So obviously, these results were exciting enough that a number of people have been pursuing this very vigorously. The ESSENCE team down at Chile, the 4-meter telescope, at the Blanco telescope, is collecting up, well, I guess Bruno will tell you more about it, but about 200 supernovae, while the other team at the Canadian, French, and Hawaiian telescope, some of which actually live not too far from here in Toronto, are about to complete a very ambitious program with 500 spectroscopically confirmed type 1A supernovae. So the reason we are so successful in finding lots of supernovae is, of course, technology-driven, mainly because the CCDs just become larger and larger, which means that we cover more and more galaxies. And this is a statistical process where you don't know where the supernova is going to explode, so you try to monitor as many galaxies as you possibly can. And of course, in each one of these galaxies, you have a probability, you know, this supernova blow once every 100 or so years. So if you have monitored for a year, thousands and thousands of galaxies, you are in a good position to find the supernovae. Now, this is the ESSENCE, the camera used by the ESSENCE team, and as you see, half a degree by half a degree. And the reason that SNLS is doing even better than that is not a surprise. It's that even more cameras, it's a huge camera. It's about a degree on side. And if you want to see how that looks in practice, this is actually the real thing. So, as I said, these are very impressive projects. The SNLS is getting to the last year of its life. So about 400 supernovae are already being discovered. A very important thing to mention here is that unlike the surveys we've done in the past, this is a survey which is we're doing in one single telescope, which reduces the some of the uncertainties enormously, because you have the same set of filters. You know, the instrument is calibrated night by night, so you are not introducing unnecessary errors as we did in the beginning, because we are trying to use, actually in some cases, like 11 telescopes to get one supernova like Lecter. So, as I said, well on track for the 500, and in fact, those are the ones with spectroscopy. There will be probably well over 1,000 supernovae with, you know, exquisite light curves, but where there was not enough telescope time to get a nice spectrum. But I think it's very likely that those supernovae will, one way or another, also make it in Hubble diagram, maybe downweighted somewhat.
Right. So these are the supernovae for which the spectroscopy is very conclusive. Now, as you go to the higher redshifts, in some cases you have a bit of less where you're not completely sure it cannot be identified. And this is the case when you have more analysis combining the spectrum and the lateral will shed more light on this. But that's about the status of that. So the reason this program is, as I was saying, is very successful is not only because of the volume, or the, excuse me, the entendu, the sort of the combination of telescope collection power of photons and the area in the sky, the angle in the sky, but it's also because we are on target very, very often. So it's four patches in the sky which are monitoring constantly in three bands, which means that you are discovering a new supernovae at the same time as you're following up the old ones, which means that you will get very, very nice light curves, and you are able to fit, as I was saying, both the peak brightness and this stretch, this light curve shape, much more accurately than we could do in the past. So this is looking very, very good. I mentioned that this, in order to identify which type of supernovae we're dealing with, you find them in a 4-meter telescope, but actually if you're going to divide the light into wavelength beams, as you have to do to get a spectrum, of course you need even larger, light collecting buckets. So you're trying to get time at the largest telescopes, like 8 and 10-meter telescopes, to get spectrum. And that's sort of, in a way, the bit of the bottleneck, what I was saying, that there might be 1,000 supernovae out of about which, only half of which, it was enough time at these large telescopes to get spectrum. It's kind of fascinating, by the way, when I think about this, that this being such a successful project, VLT just turned down for the last year or SNLS, we'll have to do without VLT because they felt that this is not necessary to keep doing this. I think it's very interesting, very European strategy, if I may say. Anyway, so how well is this looking? Well, you've all seen this result. It's a 1-year result published about a year ago or so. And as you see, the quality of the data points is much more impressive than in my first slide. Obviously, the fact we're doing this with one instrument, well-calibrated instrument, makes the scatter of points being much, much smaller than we had before. And this is, by the way, let me just, in fact, it's interesting that the scatter between the points here is also very, very comparable as the scatter at low redshift. So the whole thing looks very consistent so far. In order to make precision estimates on the equation of state parameter, the supernova data have to be combined with some other data set. Okay? So what has become very... Yes?
Sorry, why is there so lesser data lacking in between
0.1 and 0.5? I can do that. Please, the gap here. I'll do it for a minute. Yeah. It's no longer a gap, but I can do that. So in order to make...
As I said, there were all these degeneracies, as I showed in my first graph. So in order to really make a precision estimate of the equation state parameter, the supernova data is combined with other data sets, and one which has become very popular is to combine it with the distance scale defined by the Byron acoustic oscillation peak by the STSS team. And you see, this is a very well-defined scale, and you can use it as a standard rod. And when you put these two things together, of course, you get, first of all, a sharper definition of the density of dark energy. So again, these are the bananas from the supernovae, and here you have the almost orthogonal curves from Byron oscillation. And as I was advertising, what you really gain is when you're trying to get to the quantum state parameter. Again, banana kind of things from the supernovae, and this is from the Byron oscillation. And up here is the current result, or the result published in the Astier et al. Paper, where you still, the claim here at least was that you're still dominated by statistical uncertainties, where the systematics coming really, really close there. The data continues to come in, and there, as you see, this is a version, a preliminary version of the three-year data with now not 70 high-res supernovae, but 240. And again, the data is looking very, very nice. And this is actually a plot produced by Mark Sullivan, which is in Toronto. Now, back now to Stefan's question, why is this gap there, and are we trying to address this issue? Now, the gap there is just for practical reasons. There's no fundamental problem. So here, the supernovae are very, very bright, so you can find them in very small instruments. So these are dedicated people who, you know, you can sort of map the sky. I mean, they're so bright that essentially an amateur astronomer could find them. Over here, the supernovae, you need dedicated 4-meter time, but it's enough to stare at four patches in the sky, and you find four points in the sky, and you find all the supernovae showing you. Here is an in-between region. You still need large telescopes because these things are faint, and you need to map, of course, a much larger area in the sky. And this has turned out to be very, very difficult. Nobody had the telescope resources to do that until the Sloan collaboration decided this wasn't a problem to tackle. And I'm happy to report that that's been an amazingly successful project. There are, by now, almost 400 supernovae in that little gap. There was a paper in AstroPH 10 days ago or so. We just started, actually, we're part of that as well. We just started the third year, so we expect to find another 200 supernovae in this range, and it's looking. This data set is amazingly exciting because not only do we have supernovae where they were not before, the quality of the data I think will be very, very impressive. It's a very, very strong effort by many people trying to collect as good as data as possible we can here. So this is a very old graph, but just to show you that the supernova, this is the first year distribution, redshift distribution of the Sloan. To show that it really fills in the gap between the SNLS and the nearby ones. Just to complete the story about this, of course, I cannot not tell you about the efforts going on at the highest redshift 1 and higher, where the team led by Adam Rees is doing, I think, a very great job using the Hubble Space Telescope, and they're getting these gorgeous looking images where you don't need any computer to see the supernova. It's right there, and just in case, color with different color, in red, so you cannot miss it. But you see the advantage of space, that first of all, it's very, very sharp images, and it helps a lot, as I'll be showing by the end of my talk, when you're going for the highest redshifts. So let me just run through you some little animations I've been to show you what we are up against. This is the, what I'm doing here is just letting the, I'm fixing everything except for omega lambda, and I'm showing you the sensitivity of the data to omega lambda as it ramps from 0 to 1. I think it's where I stop. And what I have here, what I have here in red is the first year SNLS data, and the points in greenish are the data from HST. Okay, they're all individual supernovae. So I call this the easy part, okay? We've done this, that's why we got the Gruber Prize, because I think this is very, very clear. This detection is is very, very definitive. Now, let's see what we're up against. Now, the next thing we look at is what happens when we try to measure the equation state parameter, and now I'm letting it ramp from something like minus 2 up to 0, okay? Again, now emphasize also where the Sloan data will come in. As you see, this is the vanilla cosmology, and here's something changing, something which is not minus 1. And you see that, of course, it's very important to have the high redshift points. At the same time, the data here, you know, will be very, very good. It will be extremely high quality data. So I think, you know, with some luck, we'll be able to anchor this whole Hubble diagram very nicely with this, you know, probably 500 supernova here. Well, you know, we'll have much, in principle, better discrimination here, but we'll never get to the, we'll not get to the 500 next year as we would do with these guys. Everything fixed.
How many lambdas fixed?
I'm coming to that, yeah. Just to show you that even if I look, even doing all of that, it doesn't, you know, it looks hard, right?
So now, to make it even harder, you try to ask the question, what happens if we're trying to address the question whether it is not a, whether it's a derivative on the equation state parameter, parameterized by, in this way, you've probably seen all this before. And the point I want to drive home is that this is an extremely difficult measurement to do. You see, you know, as these things move by, you know, huge amounts, well, you know, the curves are not very, very different. And one of the reasons I'm showing this to you is that, you know, every now and then there are claims in the literature that somebody with some clever technique has found that they see a time evolution of the equation state parameter. And I think most of the time, you know, the authors are deceiving themselves because the current data cannot distinguish this. You know, you can invent some clever algorithm and you think you found it, but you know, you cannot take out more data than this data, and the data is not good enough. I'll be showing you details soon. Now, but just to comment on what Eric was saying, even so, I really cheated you because I was keeping everything fixed, while in reality, you know, we need to fit all of these four things at the same simultaneously. So the degeneracies, which I've been, you know, addressing in the past, will hit you. So this is a very tough measurement, and that's why I keep coming back to that, you know, I think supernovae are great and we should pursue them, but at the same time, we need to pursue other techniques because we need to, you know, we will need to cut these degeneracies with other techniques. I think that's very, and I think that goes for all the techniques I know of in the market that one will not cut it. We need them all, presumably. Oh, this is M-script. This is sort of the, essentially it's related that the Hubble parameter here. This has to do with the, we don't actually know. You don't know the brightness of this intrinsic of the supernovae. We just measure the relative brightness. So what we have here is the, but it, there is one more term which has to do with intrinsic brightness of supernovae and the Hubble constant, okay? This combination. We don't need to know either one of them, you know, individually, really, for this measurement, but the difference as plotted here need to be fitted. So it's a free parameter we cannot get out of, we cannot do without.
Help to nail that parameter.
Absolutely. That's really, really where I think it's going to do a fantastic job. For many reasons. One of them is that these days we do it mostly with this data, the lowest redshift data, and there's been a lot of papers in the literature recently that are issues with bulk motions
where, you know, we get to a fundamental limit how well we can measure this with the redshift less than 0.1 data. So the Sloan data is just like perfect for this. All right, so some people talk about brain wall cosmologies. So not only are we talking about trying to measure the equation of state in general terms, but there are other alternative scenarios. And just to give you a sense how things look when you cross the same data, again, the Baryon oscillations and the supernova data, this is work that I did with Malcolm Fairbairn a couple of years ago. And under the assumption, I must make this very clear, under the assumption that the only thing that affects there is no change in how structure forms, under the assumption that the only thing that changes when you go to DGP, this is, by the way, there's so much, we've been so many talks about DGP, and of course, Cedric here in the audience has been critical in, you know, in deriving this formula, how the Friedman equation looks in DGP, under the assumption that the only thing that changes is just the distance scale as affected by this new Friedman equation, then you can say that what we could say is that if you look at the statistical uncertainties, there is a bit of tension. This is where you would expect the results to land if the if you're demanding flatness. You see that these two data sets are in a little bit of tension. I don't want to overplay it. You know, it's in a bit of a tension with what you would expect in a flat scenario. That's right.
But these are only statistical errors.
And I'll try to come back to this in a second.
Sorry?
The assumption that you're making is...
That is a good question. I mean, to be quite honest with you, I'm not sure. I mean, that's why I'm making it very clear. That's the assumption, and I know, you know, I hope there are many clever people here in the audience that you know, if that assumption is... If it is a good way to change the assumption, I would be happy to do that. But that's the only assumption I need that we, you know, we can do something with.
But probably you should read this result the other way around. It's amazing how close to that, actually.
No, it's not about that,
it's
just
doing things right. Right, so now, I hope I'm being very honest about this. What are the assumptions are, if you do those assumptions, that's what I get.
So just what's that curve again? Sorry, I missed that.
Right, so this is the Barron oscillation, acoustic peak.
As I said, if you change the regular Friedman equation and replace it with this that, you know, Greg and friends have provided us with, then you see how this peak, where it would land, which omega matter, and which of this other new parameter introduced where it lands, right?
What's the solid curve going down?
I'm sorry. This is the where the flat universe solution where it should land. Let me then emphasize. There's been many nights to this only up
hours. This is one example where. Tamara Davis and friends took more data. There's more data that which was not published at the time. So they took the essence data and all the Hubble data from Adam Rees et al. And they did the same kind of analysis where these are now the supernovae, the supernova banana. This is the Barron oscillation banana. And this is now the shift parameter from the CMB. So essentially the angular scale at redshift 1100. And again, you see that there's some tension, the supernovae and the Barron oscillations want to be up here, but of course, if you force it to go through the CMB data, it sort of finds an in-between solution which has rather poor chi-squared, but of course, that's the solution. That's not really what I want to discuss here. What I want to show you again is that the devil is in the details, because we did also this analysis with Sarah Rydbeck and Malcolm about the same time. Actually, I think our papers were published in the SPH within 2-3 days difference. And what we could see is that we didn't feel very comfortable about using this data set, because it was clear to us it was made of two distinct data sets. So if you took the SNLS and SS data, you would only this region in the contours from the supernovae. If you take the so-called gold compilation from Adam Rees, you get some other things. So we are obviously, this result is dominated by systematics. So then at this point, you know, I don't feel comfortable at all about these ellipses. So that's why it's, I think, you see where I'm heading? I'm heading towards these systematics and see what they are, what do we understand, and what are the hopes to do better in the future. So let me, again, give you a very general, broad overview about what are the things that could go wrong when we do these kind of measurements. I've divided it into several categories. First of all, there are all the things which involve the nature of the supernovae, and here's where I think Bruno will talk a lot, you know, what things do we worry about, which have to do, you know, with the supernovae. How well do we can actually determine that these things are not evolving, the brightness is not evolving with time? How well do we actually understand the spectra of this object that we can accurately correct when we are working at different redshifts? We need to introduce so-called k-corrections, and those in turn depends on the many of the properties of the supernovae. So I leave most of this section to Bruno. The other thing we need to worry about is, like, you know, how, when we put things in the Hubble diagram, are they all type 1a supernovae? I mean, somebody asked me in the audience here, the word is 1a's, you know, affirmative 1a's and 1a's star. Well, here's the question. Some of these guys, to what extent we are not sure is a type 1bc, for example? Well, you get down to the signal-to-noise of your data. At some point, your spectra are not good enough, or just that you're not sure if you see all the features that you can distinguish between different types. We need to worry about that. You need to worry about the fact that it's a lot easier to find the brightest objects than the fainter ones. So unless you watch out, you would tend to find the brightest objects in the distribution as you go to larger and larger distances. We need to know how to account for that. There is this whole host of things that affect the line of sight, effects that are related with what happens between the supernova and when it explodes and when the light beam reaches us. And this is related to the fact that this is not an this star exploding is not in an isolated place. It's an environment to the galaxy where there's a lot of junk around. And the question is, how well do you determine? How well do you determine what fraction of the light actually could have scattered or been absorbed along the line of sight? And the first thing that comes to mind, of course, is dust in the host galaxy. There are also issues relating that it could be. Even if you think that the supernova is way off from the core of a galaxy, and you think, well, it's very unlikely that it hit any dust along the line of sight, it's not being ruled out, let's put it like that, that there could be also dust in between galaxies. The other effect we may have to worry about, and I'll show you this actually needs not to be, is not an issue, is gravitational lensing. Of course, as we look at supernovae from different lines of sight, they obviously pass through they go through different potentials along the line of sight from whatever distribution of galaxies there are. So it's, as I was showing it to you, different supernovae really are actually indeed magnified and demagnified. And the question is this going to be a problem or not? Bulk motions I mentioned already, let me just skip some of that. At the end of the day, the very important things, which I already alluded to, is how well do we understand the system? How well do we understand our detector, how well do we understand the calibration? And these are, well, like everyone doing experiments, of course, these things, it could take you years to understand, figure these things, and sometimes you never do. Little bit on the issue of type 1a supernovae as standard candles or standardizable, whatever you want to call it. How well do we know so far that they are the same in the near universe and the distant universe? Well, I would say that there is a lot of room for improvement there. The things we can check and have been checked are things like the light curves. What you see here in two different colors are the SNLS sample divided into sort of the median redshift, so the ones which are below and above, and you then superimpose all the light curves, and you see that there is no obvious difference between the data sets. There's no obvious differences between the light curves close to us supernovae and the distant ones, which doesn't mean there's no evolution, but at least we pass this test. Doesn't exclude it, but this is necessary but not sufficient condition, obviously. The next thing we do, trying to do, and here is something that a very large European effort has been going on to, is to get exquisite data on a handful of supernovae and trying to understand what is behind all these wiggles in the spectra. What you see here is the flux of a supernova, or actually several here, the different supernovae here, as a function of wavelength in the optical regime. And we are trying to see whether we can understand all these elements which go into there, the velocities. And in my mind, the real challenge is, can we use any of these wiggles to identify subclasses of supernovae, which if we just measure these wiggles well enough for a subset of supernovae, we'll maybe figure out that those supernovae are actually form a much sharper distribution. I'm not sure we're there, but that's definitely the goal we're trying to get to, which would be really, really important to address the issue of whether dark energy is constant or not. We really need as sharp a standard candle as we possibly can get. So these were, as I said, hand-picked supernovae, which we just go bang, with all the telescopes we can get our hands on. There are other projects which have a more of a, trying to get statistics. So there are a number of projects trying to get into the hundreds of nearby supernovae. And unfortunately, not all these projects are working in a very organized fashion, in the sense that there could be hundreds of discoveries, but not all of these supernovae maybe have enough data that you could use them for anything really sensible. I think it's fair to say, though, that the next battle front is going to be here. I think that we need to get to grips with the fact that we are not doing enough on the low redshift side for supernovae in order to calibrate and anchor the Hubble diagram and all of that sufficiently good, well, when we go out and find the high redshift supernovae. So I think I see myself, for the next several years, maybe trying to improve this part. I think that's at least would be I think we need to do that. And the very important thing is, I think we need to do it in the same clever way we're doing at high redshift. These rolling searches where we keep, you know, finding things all the time and measuring the likelihoods very accurately. So that's also very important, because there's a bit of a problem now when we combine the high redshift data set with the low redshift data set. There might be some issues there that they are found with different, in different ways. Okay? So it would be very reassuring, I think, to have a system that finds the low redshift and the high redshift supernovae in exactly the same manner, well, as exact as you can actually get. So having said a bit about the low redshift supernovae, let me then go back to the high redshift supernovae, which, as I said, are very, very important, because there is a lot of power there to discern between models. And one of the things we in our group worried quite a bit about in the beginning was whether gravitational lensing would sort of ruin this standard candle nature, or would it lead to, let's say, to selection effects in these high Z surveys. So this is an example of the kind of things that could worry you. So what I'm showing you here is a little bit box of a piece of the sky, 40 arc seconds in the sky here this way and 40 arc seconds there. And I'm showing you the position of a supernova at the, let's see, where are the redshifts? Here, redshift 1.27 in this case 1.75. And what you see in red are the four, any galaxy which is been resolved in line of sight. And what you see directly by eye, that while this guy seems to have a pretty empty line of sight, at least compared to this one seems to have a lot of neighbors in line of sight. And you might worry that, you know, that the lensing will be very different in this case than in that case. And you might worry that you would have a tendency of finding more of those guys than that, in which case you would have a subtle but, though, you know, important bias in your survey. So what we did to check for that is that we did a lot of ray tracing. We let the supernova explode here. We model all the galaxies as lenses along the line of sight using these standard scaling laws, the Tully-Fisher, the Faber-Jackson relation, because we know these galaxies, we know the brightnesses, and we try to estimate the mass. Even if that's not very accurately, it turns out to be not that critical for what I'm going to show. So lo and behold, you see that in this case, not surprisingly, we find that the line of sight here is emptier than the average, okay, and therefore, in terms of magnification mu here, I see that I expect that this supernova should be about 90%, so it should be 10% fainter than a perfect standard candle, you know, the same object placed seeing average density. I don't know if that makes it clear or not. Let's see. Well, in this case, because it is an overdensity along the line of sight, I expect this light to be magnified, and in fact, I expect it to be, this distribution shown you, our estimate of how much we should magnify. And given the uncertainties in our modeling, this is sort of the probability distribution we find for how much magnified it should be. An important point I'm trying to make here is that this one should be magnified by 10%. Right. So the two curves are for different assumptions. In one case, we're assuming in our Navarro-Frank Y profiles for these galaxies. In the other case, we assume a singular thermosphere. So it's how it's uncertain in the modeling. And then within each model, of course, there are many parameters, and those are reflected in the width of this thing. So we started doing this thinking that we would find some kind of tendency for the data points to be aligned according to the brighter ones preferentially. But actually, we found no such effect. We found that the Goetz data set seems to be really a fair sample of the universe. I mean, the distribution is as you expect from simulations, that, of course, you have a handful of magnified supernovae, but those are balanced by the ones which are demagnified. So on average, we find that this parameter mu in the southern and northern hemisphere is as close to one as we could measure. So, you know, within 1% was actually one. So we concluded that this is not the issue with this data set. Whatever the systematics are, this is not the one which is driving the problem. Just for fun, by the way, and to check whether some homework to check whether what we're doing makes sense. And you expect statistically that if our modeling is right, you should, even if the effect is very small, eventually you will see a correlation between what we estimate should be the magnification and how these guys deviate from the Hubble diagram. And actually, you know, I'm not going to make a huge claim here, but I'm going to say we had about, with 90% confidence level, we found that our analysis, you know, seemed sound in a sense that the correlation we found is pretty much what we expected for this data set. So that's giving us some reassurance that the way we address the problem seems to make sense. Now, the reason I maybe also want to say some more words about this, because actually somebody asked me during the conference, and I think actually Cedric and I talked about this, the lensing effect is of course not only limiting for supernovae, but for any object you want to do cosmology with at high redshifts. So one example is this fantastic event that we hope LISA will find eventually, these coalescing black holes, you know, 10 to the 7, 10 to the 8 solar masses black holes, and those will produce these, you know, gravitational wave sirens, which are essentially the counterpart of the supernovae, but in gravitational waves. And people are, sorry? Well, I'm coming to that. They're better than the supernovae. However, they're not. Here's the punchline. They are much sharper to begin with. However, they will be blurred, just like the, you know, gravity bends gravitational waves as well. So they will be affected by whatever is in line of sight. So at the end of the day, you will have 10% effects also to those guys, meaning that at the end of the day, they are not better standard candles than 10%. You see what I'm saying? So they are better, but not as good as they thought. Now, the reason, okay, so that's a negative remark. Now, the positive remark is that, you know, we think by this kind of analysis that we are getting clever about how to correct this. These are individual lines of sight. We measure all the galaxies. I'm sure whenever LISA finds one of those guys, we'll just go with all the optical telescopes, and we just map out an infrared, map out all the galaxies along the line of sight of those galaxies, and we'll be able to make corrections just, you know, as at least as good as the ones we did here. And I think we're getting the sense that that might actually take us back. We cannot win all the effect back, of course, but the 10% might become more like a 3%. So we actually, I'm very optimistic that it will be very useful. Of course, you know, whether LISA ever finds anything like that, that's another story. Now, yeah.
You're right. I mean, you don't necessarily have to find the galaxies, you just find background galaxies and measure the same ones as you want.
So you mentioned lens and the radius from back in galaxy to set.
Yeah, I mean, not maybe if you have 10,000, you know, if you're relying on 10 or 20 of them with that redshift, you can just measure the lensing in those directions.
But by which thing do you think now?
Well, if you go by
the other word, but this is a different scale, right? This is, you know, this is galaxy lensing, right? Will you be able to map, you know, at the arc second level with weak lensing? I don't think you can.
No, but there's an intermediate. I mean, I'm working on galaxy-out lensing,
right.
In the deep end, the wide fields, and you can calibrate your galaxy-galaxy lensing model, your Kelly Fisher, Faber-Jackson, using weak shear.
You can measure, and then you have a model.
Okay.
You can definitely measure it better than your model.
Okay, which is definitely talk about. I mean, this is great stuff.
You're not going to know from putting in isothermal profiles or NFLU profiles,
right,
or that you know from measuring the lens.
Let me just, I mean, this is great, so let's talk about it. The reason I want to move on is because I think for the supernova, we have much worse problem. That's why let me just get to that.
The real headache with supernovae, I think, which, by the way, will not be a problem with sirens, is the fact, this you know, annoying dust along the line of sight, which is very hard to pin down on an individual basis. It's very hard for us to know which dust, what was the, you know, the dust, you know, the how much scattering and absorption the light from a particular supernova suffered. And what people happens is that we do corrections on average, right? So either we say that, for example, all the galaxies in the universe have dust distributions which are just like the Milky Way, and we say, and that's a very, if you think about it, it's a very dramatic statement, which actually we do all the time with this kind of measurement. We say that all the galaxies have exactly the same, you know, distribution of dust sizes as the Milky Way. And that's interesting because we don't even understand exactly what's going on in the Milky Way in terms of dust. So it's a very bold assumption. The other approach, which is pursued by the SNLS, is to say, well, no, that's not true. All the galaxies do not look like the Milky Way, but they're all the same. They're all just all different, but all the same. So you make an average fit of all the galaxies, and you assume they all follow the same Redding law. I'm going to argue that that's probably not good enough. What I think, and maybe I'm being sort of a pessimist here. Maybe I'm following sort of, now I got into Hector's mood yesterday when he was telling us how difficult everything was. I feel a little bit like this about dust, that I think what it really takes is to measure on each supernova, have enough wavelength range that you can actually pin down what is the reddening that particular supernova suffered, which also means, of course, going back to the physics of the supernova, knowing, you know, what was the intrinsic color of the supernova to begin with, and neither one of these two things are easy to do. Let's see, there are some exceptions which I don't have time to discuss. We think and hope that for supernova and elliptical galaxies, this problem will be less acute because we think there's much less dust in those environments. But I'll skip that unless there's questions. Very, very quick crash course on dust and extinction laws. These are extinction laws our galaxy. This is the average value. This is sort of somewhat of the extremes found in our own galaxy. So don't, you know, just to let me, for the rest of my talk, which is only just 10 minutes, I'll be using that as the, I'll be describing these curves with this one parameter called R sub V. And what you see here is this is one over wavelength, this is the visual band, and here you move towards the UV, and here towards infrared. You see that depending on what this parameter is, the ratio of extinction, say, from any given wavelength to the visual could vary substantially. People don't know. People do not know, actually. There are ideas, but people do not know. So, I mean, that already says, and you see, actually, there are, in other galaxies, let's see, which one is it? In this small Magellanic cloud, the dust green. Here, you see, there is no bump. So it's not even, as I said, there, already there, you see that in some galaxies, it doesn't even have this bump. So much of the differences between the different teams depends on what value people pick. I mean, simply put, that's it. People assume the some value here. The SNLS teams actually assume something even higher here, based on of course, on data. But this is sort of the real problem right now. And if you look at a nearby supernovae where you can measure this accurately, you see that, well, you know, not surprisingly, you find a range of these parameters. Here's a supernova 06CX where people measure from the UV to the K-band. And, you know, the best fit is something like 1.5. Here's somebody who picked the spectra and found 1.24. Here's somebody who found for supernova something that maybe is compatible 3.1. My point being that, you know, we don't know. I mean, that there could be a range. So you had a...
intergalactic material, I mean, that could dust or gas, that could lead to a systematic error in higher
pressure. I think quite a bit of that. We have upper limits coming from independent techniques that at least tells us that that's a much less smaller problem than this. But we can, I can explain this, how we do this afterwards. But my point being that right now,
being kind of naive, and we assume that all supernovas have the same dust properties, and that's might not be the best thing to do. So. Just to give you a little bit of amusement, I'll show you a little program we've written with some students trying to show to you how some of the systematic uncertainties would move around the best fit cosmology. Okay, just to give you a sense for how much things would be moved, let me just see if I can run this in real time. So what I'm showing you here is the W naught WA combinational parameters. Let me switch off the thing. The data which is being fitted here is the Rees et al. Gold set, and for purpose of demonstration, which by the way you see does not, this is the one sigma value, it does not really, the 68%, sorry, confidence region, and it does not cross through the cosmological constant, which will be right here. For pedagogical reasons, I've divided the data set into three redshift bins, the low redshift, some up to redshift 0.1, the ones from 0.1 to 0.7 here, which corresponds roughly to the ones on the ground, and the high Z starting from 0.7 and upwards, which correspond, roughly speaking, to the ones from space. And because the name of the game, in my mind, is to see what happens when you start to introduce correlated error bars between many supernovae, if you do a wrong assumption, it's not going to affect only one, but it's going to affect groups of supernovae, right? I could change any of these parameters, which, for example, have to do with how well the redshift could be measured, whether this parameter I just told you is really galactic, whether, you know, what happens if I change this value, what happens if I introduce a scatter, meaning that, you know, whatever the number is, it's going to be a scatter. And let's see, just to give a sense how things change, for example, if I were to change this RV parameter in the high Z supernovae, and put what the SNLS team is using, sure enough, it moves down to cover the lambda cosmology. So here's straight up why, for example, the SNLS team finds something more consistent with cosmology constant than the Goods team does, right? Just it all boils down to what assumed for extinction. I mean, that's one of the things that hit you.
That we don't actually know regions of the sky that have an
extension
like that.
Which one? 1.6. I just showed you the paper. I even signed it.
There's no place in our own galaxy.
Oh, our own galaxy. But we're talking about galaxy like this one. I showed you 1.6. 1.5.
Why not? You look on the right diagram. Look at the difference between 2.1 and 3.1. Okay. It's almost in all cases it's within the error bars.
Wait. Again, I'm arguing that nothing can be stupid, right? I'm not arguing that it should be perfect. I'm saying that there is a range here which is definitely perturbable. This guy, I would say 1.5 makes a very good thing. I would think that Elia Sosa
thinks that 1.24 and there makes a good fit. I'm not saying that she's right or wrong. I'm saying that this question has not been settled.
I think I made my point clear. I'm exposing our ignorance. It's not that I claim I know the answer. I'm just saying that once you take into account our ignorance, this is how things move. I'm not selling you another value. I'm just saying that's within the uncertainty. You could add, for example,
if you keep going, you can change the other redshift bean to the same thing. What's this? Anything's move. You could say, maybe whatever the number is, there has to be spread. So maybe the standard deviation is like one of these things. Let's see, why is this thing wanting me to do something? I don't want that. Okay. So anyway, my point being that, and I don't have time to go into this detail, that the point I think I want to convey here is that when people, cosmologists in the audience, theorists in the audience, take the statistical confidence regions which are quoted, and want to prove this or disprove that, watch out, because this is a minefield. You might easily fool yourself. That's the only point I want to drive home, that this is the data is not good enough for this. That the last 3 minutes or so, this whole discussion is leading me towards saying that we need really substantially better instruments to solve this one. And we need Lisa. I don't disagree with you. But why Lisa? Let's see. Here's a point I think we have to be very honest, is that the fact we can do all these estimates and look at all the systematic uncertainties is because the supernova field has matured quite a bit, right? We are in a position that we understand what we do not know, and I think that puts us in the line of fire, because, for sure, we can expose, I can show our dirty laundry to you, but many of these new techniques might be fabulous, but it's not, at least, I think, not ruled out, as far as I know, that they haven't thought of all the systematics, right? That we were definitely naive when we started doing these things with supernovae, and now the more we do, we more really realize, I think there is a fair chance that something similar could happen to, the weak lensing technique, the Baryon oscillation technique. I, of course, hope I'm wrong on this one, but I'm saying one has to allow for the possibility that people have not been all that thorough about thinking of systematics. So if we want to move forward here, what you really want is a really wide coverage in wavelength range for all the reasons I showed you. I showed you a few examples where we were able to fit the extinction parameters of a dust in the host galaxy just by the fact that we had all the way from U-band to infrared photometry, So I think that's very important, I think, that we can actually do this right. And the next thing I think will be very... but the next thing which I'm less sure about, I should say, but may be very important, is that if we're clever enough to find that there's a second parameter which, say, we can sharpen the intrinsic scatter of this type 1a supernovae by identifying subclasses maybe having to do with the spectra, well, then having a spectrograph in your survey might be very important. This one, as I said, I'm less sure about than the first one. So the other thing I think, in my mind, we should at least be open-minded about is that we want to do this in large fields of view, because at least as an experimental, as an observer, I think that there are two ways we can disprove the cosmological constant. One of them, of course, if it is not constant in time. But the other one is if it is not constant in space. So maybe this is sort of desperate hope, but I think anyway we should be open for that possibility, that look for anisotropies in the dark energy distribution or equation state. Right, Eric and friends have been came up with this VPAC report the other day, and they, I think, supported the idea that we should go ahead with some kind of dark energy mission. And so that's, I don't know if you heard that, but there was the some sort of ranking of the timescales for which different of the beyond Einstein probes should be take place. And the dark energy mission, one of which being the SNAP satellite, which I'll have 3 seconds to talk about, is one of the contenders. So there is at least some, it seems to me, some interest from NASA to go ahead and investigate the nature of dark energy with probes like supernovae or baryon oscillations or weak lensing or all of the above. But I think they very wisely identify that the what really will be the decisive figure of merit, I think, will be how well these different techniques can control systematic uncertainties. And I think there we are in a good shape in this, quote unquote, in the sense that we understand what we need to understand. I think that's a good part. So one of the projects where, again, I'm involved in is this SNAP satellite, which essentially has the ambition to try to nail systematics, hopefully to the required level. Again, I think it's early days now to say that we can do better, we do it better than others, but I think it's at least that's a goal, that this will be include both imaging and spectroscopy in a wide range of filters in order to do what I just said, figure out all the color issues, and maybe compare like to like, meaning if you really drive home this thing with spectroscopy where it really finds some pluses, then we will not just make one big Hubble diagram, but we'll make many small comparing much, much sharper standard candles. And so as I'm sure you're all aware, of course, the half of the SNAP collaboration is not in for supernova, I would say three quarters of the SNAP collaboration is actually weak lensing people, which think it's an absolutely fabulous instrument to do weak lensing measurements. And as I think has been emphasized here, we need, of course, both to probe the expansion rate of the universe and the growth of structure if we're going to be really, you know, be able to tell whether, you know, it's modified gravity, who is really doing the thing, you know, which part of the equation, is it the curvature term in Einstein equations or the energy momentum tensor, which has to be changed? And to be quite honest, I think we need at least two techniques, the ones probing the expansion rate, H of Z, and the growth of rate, G of Z, or whatever you want to call it. And of course, lensing, as we were told the other day, of course, has this fantastic power of trying both. It both depends on the relative distances here, but also, of course, on where the lenses are, i.e. the growth of matter. So just to end, the funny thing is I left particle physics like 15 years ago because I was fed up. I was in part of this experiment with 500 people and nobody listened to what I said. So I went to ask cosmology, and now at the end of the day, I find myself in an experiment which actually for all practical purposes reminds me very, very much of the kind of big science I thought I had escaped. Nevertheless, I think, however, as I think also Andrew Lang was showing also in his collaborations how things ramp up in a number of people, these are hard enough experiments that actually takes all these people. So they're not only placed, not only flags in the map, they are really important scientists working on this. And just to close, an example where people have been looking at sort of crossing supernovae, CMB and weak lensing, And without going into details, this sort of gives you the sense when, that when you combine at least the techniques of weak lensing and supernovae, this is what you are probably going to get, okay? This is the precision. We might argue if this is the last word on this. I don't think it is, but this is sort of the target at least. So I think it's probably I'm out of time, right? So that's, yeah, I close here.
In this business of getting rid of dust, the ideal thing would just be to just use elliptical galaxies. So it's a naive question. What happens if you take all the data we've got now and throw away everything that's not from an elliptical galaxy and just look at that? Can any reasonable conclusions be drawn?
It's exactly what we're doing right now, actually. So we're trying to put together the SLS data and the SON data
analytical only. We're trying to answer your question. I mean, that's the obvious thing we're looking into right now, but I don't have a number yet. But we're looking into them.
The possibility to help W equal to minus one, I mean, from our original point of view. In other words, should we theorists be investing some time on constructing models which would help W less than minus one? Because that's very challenging from a theory point of view. Would it be possible at some point, even in principle?
You mean bigger than
W or more negative?
More
negative, W less than minus one.
Well, as you see here, in a way, it's not more difficult to measure in this direction than that direction. So in that sense, sure, go ahead and then go.
Would you ever have a precision?
No, I thought you meant it this way, right?
Oh, don't be nuts at the bottom. Right?
Yeah. I'm saying I think we're pretty symmetric, so.
No, I get that.
So
the question is the precision.
Eventually, you have the precision.
To tell us all, how do you do this? It's one for sure.
I tend to think about. For me, the target is at which point don't exclude minus one here, right? At which point. And I think, I think it will be hard to do with anything less than snap. I think it will be very hard to convince people that we exclude the logic conference. Either it's going positive or negative.
So, but anyway, what does mean this 5%? You see, the question is what you will be able to reach finally considering accuracy.
Right. Yeah.
Take the most optimistic point.
If you have two free parameters, we're actually done here today to some extent, right? If you only have one parameter, then this is essentially what our we need here from now. But if you want to fit both parameters, then you need an experiment like this, and then you get 5% of this one and 0.1 or so.
But if you would assume, for instance, if you would take bias, the W prime is equal to zero, right?
Yeah.
Yes. Then what would be your accuracy? It would be better
than this. Oh, we'd be better than this, yeah.
And 5% is your own, that is 68% confidence.
Yes.
Zero.
Yes. Actually, that's not my work, though. It is offers, but I believe that's what you claim mean. Yeah,
that's right. If you assume the cost in W, then you get down to 2% with these data sets that you basically all take.
Right, I mean, at the 5-6% level, that's what we're now, actually.
Yeah, but how much do you be able to do better after this satellite will come, if it will come at all?
What's the best case scenario?
I think we're looking at 1%.
1%? So yeah. You'll be about 3.5K.
Well, if you look at it that way, it might not be much better than that. I mean, we can argue 1 or 2, but it's not going to be, I don't think it's going to be more than 1,000, just to put it like that.
Yeah, but okay, it's a question about systematic studies.
Yes.
So, do you have any kind of hopes that you could subclassify these?
I do. That's what I'm doing. Yeah, I do.
That's where you're using that hope to get at your 1%.
That's right. It's the same hope that people use for LISA with the black hole. I mean, it's just you assume that you have something.
Let me get this. Of course, now, maybe I was not very. This whole chapter I skipped, which is everything we're doing between now and SNAP. Now we are involved in a huge number of surveys from the ground trying to measure these things with great accuracy so that we think we'll understand the systematics to a thing. We do much in a much better shape, when we launch this thing, if we ever do, 10 years from now or 7 years from now, whatever it is. But it's not that we're waiting then and we're hoping for everything to, just wow, we learn everything. is a very enormous, I mean, enormous and ambitious program going on now to nail on things. So I think progress, I would be surprised if nothing comes out of that. That's what I'm making my decision.
I'm just saying, to get to 1% error, that's the best you could possibly do.
Well, let me turn around this question. If I'm smart enough, now I'm not, but I have some colleagues that who are, if I'm smart enough to sharpen the standard calculation, if we find...
But you're assuming that a very smart person could do that to the limit of statistics.
Right.
And it's not clear that nature will allow it.
Right. Now, there is no fundamental limitation of the supernova. I mean, in statistics, in principle, we could just go on and on.
No, but I'm saying maybe these things, even if you know everything about the spectrum, they're still variable fundamentally in some way.
Right.
Okay?
Right. So
the assumption of 1% says that there is no intrinsic variability that you cannot regress away if you know enough else about it.
Right.
Okay. And that's an assumption which may not be true.
Right. That's what we're trying to work hard with supernova models and those things, trying to understand what is the reasonable range of intrinsic practices that we could actually expect to have. The question is not, is the derivative, how much do things drift after the range that you're talking about? And yes, I mean, the jury is still out there. I don't think anyone has the answer, but people are working very hard to try to nail it.
But to get you expected as a supernova, okay, a changing very much, as you said, nature, when you go from redshift 1 to 1.5, I don't think that should be tremendous evolutionary.
Let's see, I think that's a group we'll be talking about very vision. So that question I postponed to this talk. Yeah.
Also, the media, I think, okay, you can measure also chemical elements. This region, and if there is no tremendous change in the composition of the life, change in the reality.
There are days where I completely tend to agree with you, and there are dark days where I'm worrying more about this thing. So, today is a good day. Today I think often think about it. But, tomorrow could be different.
Okay, let's thank our earlier.